Thank you, Rabbi Glasser. And thank you to everybody who's joining us here this evening. As you'll hear, I'm from originally from England, which hasn't been in the news at all for the past 24 hours. But I've been here now for 14 years as professor of Jewish philosophy. And recently in July, just in the summer, became the Dean of Revel, which has been a great honor of mine. And tonight you'll hear both a little bit from me, something a little philosophical, and then from Dr. Perelis, one of our Jewish historians. So you'll get a taste of some of the things that we do at the Revel Graduate School. As Rabbi Glasser mentioned, what I'm going to talk about tonight in the time that we have is something that really, I suppose, was inspired by Emmanuel Levinas. So Emmanuel Levinas, for those who don't know, was born in 1906 in Lithuania. He died 1995 in Paris. And he was born into a very Jewish environment. The way that he puts it is being Jewish was as natural as having eyes and ears. So he's born very much in that Eastern European hotbed of Judaism. He would move to France, where he would become most famous, albeit latterly. He was already in his 50s before he really had much philosophical influence, became very, very influential as a French philosopher. However, he was always highly involved in the Jewish community, even before he was actually an academic philosopher. And other than his philosophical works, which focus very much, he's very well known for trying to bring ethics back to its place of primacy in philosophy. But other than those works, he also brought out a number of volumes of Talmudic readings. So on the one hand, you have this very dense philosophical material. On the other hand, and actually with a different publisher, he brought out a number of these Talmudic readings, which it's fair to say, if you're used to brisker learning, that certainly was not the style he was using. He was taught by this famous, almost infamous figure, Monsieur Shushani, a somewhat mysterious figure who apparently would turn up looking somewhat like a vagrant. But was this Talmudic genius who taught Elie Wiesel amongst others. And Levinas would turn up and for bed and board teach until he'd just decide to get up on his way and go and leave again. And he really inspired Levinas to take the Talmud very seriously and to really engage it, but to engage it qua philosopher. So what I want to do in the brief time we have is really just highlight an idea that is inspired by a couple of Levinas's Talmudic readings, but one in particular that is highly relevant to Pesach, where he's commenting on a Mishnah, and its Mishnah actually appears in the Haggadah. And the topic that I'm going to bring this Levinasian idea to bear upon is that of freedom. Right. So, you know, this is we are entering Zman Chirutenu, Me'avdut L'Chirut, and freedom matters. Right. Clearly, freedom is incredibly important to us as human beings and indeed to Jews and to Judaism. Right. So if you just think about from a Jewish perspective, but one can clearly apply this beyond Judaism. If you perform mitzvot, because somebody's put a gun to your head, then it's not clear that your observance is worth very much, right? If you're doing it because you are coerced into doing it, then it's not clear that your observance is particularly worthy. It's interesting, actually, there are those who think that Maimonides, in a very famous responsa, where he is somewhat lenient with those who had forcibly converted to Islam And this is because they were forced. They were told, unless you recite the Shahada, unless you recite the formulation that commits you to Islam, you'll be killed. And Maimonides says, yeah, but, you know, even they know you don't mean it, right? They've got a gun to your head and you say, yes, yes, I'm going to say it. And you say, even they know you can't really mean it. And therefore he's lenient. So the fact is that we think that there's something important about us performing mitzvot of our own free volition, right? So, you know, we think of free will as being free from coercion. That's number one. But even more than that, there are all these metaphysical questions that arise regarding free will. And there are challenges to the idea that you as an individual have free will, regardless of whether anybody's got a gun to your head, right? So somebody has a gun to your head and forces you to do something. Now, the fact is, there might be people who will refuse and won't do it despite these dreadful conditions. Okay, that might be the case. I imagine most people, again, from a Jewish perspective, in most cases, justifiably, we would do what the person with the gun to our head tells us, right? So you still have an element, shall we say, of free choice, even with a gun to your head. It's barely free choice. Most people are going to go in one direction, but I can still make that decision. Or can I? You see, modern science has challenged even that idea. So forget the gun to your head. Just in terms of anything and everything that you do, to what extent is it genuinely a free choice between two alternatives? And to what extent is it actually determined by your history up to that point? So if the scientists argue, and there are many different routes to this idea, but if a scientist argues that everything is a matter of cause and effect, right? Everything in the physical world is a matter of cause and effect, and human beings, as part of that physical world, similarly subject to cause and effect. Therefore, actually, anything I do is determined by its prior causes. It's cause, effect, cause, effect, cause, effect. And however it might feel from the inside, the challenge that is put to us, and as I say, you can do it at the atomic level, right, in terms of physics and determinism, or we can think more culturally and psychologically and environmentally at a kind of more, at a broader macro level. But there are many, many people who challenge the idea that we actually have free will, that we are able to choose between two alternatives. And to us, that's very threatening. If that's true, that's a very threatening idea, because it means that, albeit I think, albeit you think, let us say, that you freely chose to come here tonight, and good on you, actually, it was determined since the beginning of time that you would be here at this point right now. So no pat on the back. Or indeed, if I give you a pat on the back, it's determined that I was going to do so, so it's still meaningless. The fact is that these challenges to free will are both scientific and theological. The idea of divine foreknowledge, that God knew you were going to be here, and therefore could you do anything but be here tonight? Again, very challenging. Now, the vast majority, if not all Jewish philosophers, there are some exceptions, would argue that free will is absolutely fundamental. Because with free will comes responsibility. We need free will. Because it's only because I chose to do something that I deserve to be either praised or blamed for it. My choice, I chose to do it. Well, that means, okay, either good on you, or you deserve to be punished because you chose to do the bad thing. So it's absolutely fundamental. Hafstai Kreskas talks about it as one of the principles. Bechira, right, is one of the fundamental principles of Judaism for this very reason. Because the idea of a commandment only makes sense if I can choose to act in accordance with it or choose not to. So free will really matters, and that's what we celebrate over Pesach. And yet, free will is actually a deeply puzzling, quite an interesting concept. Because we like to think of free will in terms of, to use a lovely image from Borges, who actually Professor Perelis can tell you a lot more about than I can, the garden of forking paths. At each point, there's a forking path, and I can choose A, I can choose B, alternate possibilities. That's how we think of free will intuitively. I have alternate possibilities. I could do A, I could do B. But actually, free will turns out to be rather more complicated than that. And the idea that Levinas tries to motivate when he's discussing this, and with this, we will turn to the Mishnah in question. So this is kind of very well known Mishnah, right, from Masechet Brachot, that appears in the Haggadah, right? So right near the beginning of the Haggadah, very famously, right, Maskirin Yitziat Mitzrayim Balelot, right, that we are supposed to mention, we are supposed to commemorate, right, remember the Exodus from Egypt at nighttime, right? Amar Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Hare ani kaven shivim shana v'lo zachiti shetei amei yitziat Mitzrayim b'leila ad shedrasha ben zoma. Right, and so Elazar ben Azariah tells us that it took him all the way to the age of, well, kaven shivim shana. Right, well known that as 70 years, because he aged prematurely when he stood up and was put up to become the head of the Sanhedrin. But he says, right, I didn't realize it's there. And I, until this drasha of Ben Zoma, which is what? Interpreting Devarim, Lamantis got Yom Seit Chomer, Strayim, Kol Yomei Chayecha. And the drasha is Yomei Chayecha, Hayamim, Kol Yomei Chayecha, Halelot. Okay, there's another one that deals with Yomot HaMashiach, but we're going to concentrate on this night and day idea. Because, of course, what is the commemoration of Yitziat Mitzrayim at nighttime? Well, we say the third paragraph of the Shema. Right? And Levinas, pointing at that, says, what is it that is a remembrance for us when we're doing, when we're saying the third paragraph of the Shema? What's supposed to remind us of these things? Remind us of mitzvah in general. Well, tzitzit, right? Where you look at, yeah, ritemoto, you look at your tzitzit, and that's how we remember. And what does that mean? What does Levinas kind of want to do with that? Well, he wants to say the following, that we're commemorating our freedom, right? We're going from bondage to freedom. And we recall that by looking at what? At something that reminds us of our obligations, right? Now, obligations aren't a gun to the head, right? But they're certainly a curb on unfettered freedom, right? No, you have to do this and you must not do that. And there's rewards and there's punishments in order to try and encourage you in that direction. So Levinas points to the fact that our commemoration of freedom is something that grows out of our knowledge of our obligations. Now, number one, that's important because freedom isn't just license, right? That a freedom that's worthy of the name, the freedom that actually would bring with it moral responsibility, for which you can be held responsible, can't simply be random, unmotivated acts. There I am, I've got my forking path, and I could do A, I could do B. Well, is it a toss of a coin? Is it random? Am I literally caught between the two, with nothing motivating me one way or the other? such that 50-50 could go either way, but that just seems to be then an arbitrary choice. It seems to be random. And that doesn't seem to bring with it a notion of responsibility or freedom. So the fact is, one hopes, most of us, if we're faced with choices, we know what we're going to do, right? If if I walk past a burger store and there's a smell of a cheeseburger, right? Do I really want to be in a position where it's 50-50? Oh, I could go in, could not. What's going to happen today? Oh, I went in. Right? Or would I prefer to be the kind of person who, given that I have taken on a way of life, actually don't really give a second thought to the other path? And I just simply walk past because that's of no interest to me. It's not a live option. So immediately, what Levinas here is motivating is the idea that freedom's a little more complex than one might think. Because if you walk in here and think freedom, yes, of course, two forking paths, I could go either way. Actually, it's not clear that's a freedom worth having. And in fact, do we not want to rather be people who are motivated by things that are somewhat predictable, indeed, that maybe follow some kind of causal chain? But I don't want to be at the mercy of just, ooh, my brain just went bang and I went that way. Don't I want to be the kind of person who's actually been brought up with particular character traits, virtues, obligations that make me not think of the other path and make me do the thing because I have chosen to do that thing, but I've chosen it because that's the kind of guy I am. Think about it, moral responsibility. If freedom really is just could go either way, to what extent is that an act you're really responsible for? I'm responsible for an act that I do because it reflects who I am and my character, and therefore you can blame me. But if we're constantly just there at the 50-50, could go this way, could go that way, to what extent does that reflect you? To what extent is that your action? And what Levinas does here is something that he reinforces elsewhere. Because in that very famous kind of midrash that you find in Shabbat, Peichet, right? Kafar lehem harka gigit. The idea that the Israelites were underneath the mountain and it was turned upside down on top of them. And, you know, either accept the Torah, here will be your graves. And we all think of that as a dreadful way to engage with the obligations, right? That's an enforced contract, right? That doesn't seem to be a valid contract. It's been forced upon us. How can that be? And indeed, right? Chazal therefore try and deal with that and later, you know, find a way out of it. Purim actually being the place, Kimu v'Kiblu, where they voluntarily reaffirm this commitment. So even the rabbis are troubled by this idea that we might have entered into our obligations in a way that was somehow enforced. But Levinas points to the following. He asks, can you choose to be free? Okay, think about it. Can you choose to be free? Well, if you're choosing to be free, aren't you already free if you've got choice? Right? There's a kind of paradox there. Can you choose to be free? Well, no, because if you're choosing to be free, you're already making a choice, right? A free choice means you're already free. So where does freedom come from? And Levinas' point is that freedom is born of unfreedom, of something other than freedom. That there's almost this very complex, call it dialectic maybe, between freedom and unfreedom. That freedom either is something that just appears ex nihilo, but certainly can't be chosen. And the point here goes back, traces back to the individual and their choice. So on the one hand, he's talking about we go through to freedom, and freedom comes really, says he, or is we are reminded of it through our obligations. Because actually it's obligations, it's some such narrative, some such network of commitments that gives you a genuine freedom worthy of the name, rather than making you into a somebody who is at the mercy of random whims. We want to be the kind of people who follow a path and do so for reasons. And because I'm somebody who is committed to whatever it might be, Kashrut, to use the example we used just before, I want that decision. I want that muscle, so to speak, to make me walk past. And I don't want to have, worked hard at my commitments and then just be at the mercy of randomly one day for no apparent reason walking in and having the cheeseburger, right? That seems strange. So therefore we want to commit to a path that maybe is a path of causation, a path where, no, you know what? It's because I've done these things and the kind of person I am, and that causes me to do the things that I want to do and not be at the mercy of randomness and not do the things, right? I've done all that work, but randomly I could, if I'm really free, I could just go off and do the other thing. Is that freedom that's actually worthy of the name? So what Levinas is trying to get us to understand in both of these instances is, number one, that is out of obligation, right? It's the sit-sit, seeing that that's being the symbol that we refer to when we are commemorating our freedom, is precisely because a freedom worthy of the name actually isn't about just random choice between two alternatives. And it's actually maybe about entering into some form of obligation. And hence his reading of that particular Mishnah and his reading of whatever it was that happened at Ma'amad Har Sinai, or the particular Midrash that describes it in a way that we find, that many of us find so troubling, maybe is revealing a deep truth. That freedom, a freedom worthy of the name, the freedom that brings with it responsibility, which is where we began, right? Freedom is important. Why? Because we think it grounds responsibility. Why? Because only if I chose to do the right thing should I be praised for it. Only if I choose to do the wrong thing should I be blamed for it, right? That freedom brings with it responsibility. But a randomness doesn't seem to bring with it responsibility. So what is a freedom that is on the one hand not a literal gun to the head, or is not literally everything is determined by the cause that came before, that came before, that came before, but yet doesn't fall into complete randomness? And the truth is, it's very, very difficult to define in some robust philosophical manner the nature of a free will worthy of the name. But one thing that is very clear is that a complete license to do anything doesn't seem to bring with it the kind of responsibility that we're so desperate to find. And therefore, when we're thinking here about me avdut lecheirut, for Levinas and the Levinasian idea is actually, you know what? All freedom is kind of bound up with a form of slavery, obviously not, but some form of shibud, some form of being in thrall to something that is causal, something that is obligatory, but certainly makes us think again about the nature of freedom and why it is maybe that there's a sense in which remembering where it comes from remains important, even when we're trying to define it latterly. So what you end up with here, by the way, is the notion of free will as a total mystery. Okay, so free will ultimately ends up being a grand mystery, right? Which has a rather good pedigree in Jewish thought as well. If you want to know more about that mystery, obviously I would invite you to come and join us at Revel, because you can not only do philosophy, you can do all these other things as well, including, as you'll see there, Jewish history. And you can find us through the internet, web. Come join us, take a course. You can audit, but more importantly, right now, you can hear from Professor Ronnie Pirellis, who will do something more historical with you, and hopefully leave you a little less confused by the end. But teasing you with these questions is just to draw you in and bring you back, please God. I wish everybody a Chag Kasher Sameach. Apparently, since this is a taste of Pesach already, it's not too early for that. And I will pass over to my esteemed colleague, Professor Ronnie Pirellis.